And now, Saturday Night Theatre. We begin our T.S. Eliot centenary celebration here on Radio 4 with a new production of Eliot's last play. Frederick Treves leads the cast as Lord Claverton in The Elder Statesman.
Is your father at home today?
You'll see him at tea.
No, but if I'm not going to have you to myself, there's really no point in my staying at tea.
But you must stay to tea. That was understood when you said you could give me the whole afternoon.
But I couldn't say what I wanted to say to you over luncheon.
That's your own fault. You should have taken me to some other restaurant instead of to one where the maitre d'hotel and the waiters all seem to be your intimate friends.
It's the only place where I'm really well known and get well served. And when you're with me, it must be a perfect lunch.
It was a perfect lunch. But I know what men are. They like to show off. That's masculine vanity. To want to have the waiters all buzzing round you. And it reminds the girl that she's not the only one who's been there with him.
Well, tease me if you like, but a man does feel a fool if he takes you to a place where he's utterly unknown and the waiters all appear to be avoiding his eye.
We're getting off the point.
You've got me off my point. I was trying to explain.
It's simply the question of your staying to tea, as you practically promised.
What you don't understand is that I have a grievance. On Monday you're leaving London with your father. I arranged to be free for the whole afternoon, on the plain understanding.
But you should stop to tea.
And then you took me on a shopping expedition.
If you don't like shopping with me...
Of course I like shopping with you. Very well, then, I will stop to tea. But you know I won't get a chance to talk to you. You know that. Now that your father's retired, he's at home every day. And you're leaving London. And because your father simply can't bear it that any man but he should have you to himself... Before I've said two words, he'll come ambling in.
You've said a good deal more than two words already. And besides, my father doesn't amble. You're not at all respectful.
I try to be respectful. But you know that I shan't have a minute alone with you.
You've already had several minutes alone with me, which you've wasted in wrangling. But seriously, Charles, Father's sure to be buried in the library, and he won't think of leaving it until he's called for tea. So why not talk now? Though I know very well what it is you want to say. I've heard it all before.
And you'll hear it again. You think I'm going to tell you once more that I'm in love with you? Well, you're right. But I've something else to say that I haven't said before that'll give you a shock. I believe you love me.
Oh, what a dominating man you are. Really, you must imagine you're a hypnotist.
Is this a time to torment me? But I'm selfish in saying that because I think you're tormenting yourself as well.
You're right. I am. Because I am in love with you.
So I was right. Oh, the moment I said it, I was badly frightened, for I didn't know you loved me. I merely wanted to believe it, and I've made you say so.
And I hear someone coming. Oh. It's Lambert with the tea. And I shall say... Lambert, please let his lordship know that tea is waiting.
Yes, Miss Monica.
I'm very glad, Charles, that you can stay to tea.
And your father will come with his calm, possessive air and his kindly welcome, which is always a reminder that I mustn't stay too long, for you belong to him. He seems so placidly to take it for granted that you don't really care for any company but his.
You're not to assume that anything I've said to you has given you the right to criticise my father. In the first place, you don't understand him. In the second place, we're not engaged yet.
Aren't we? We're agreed that we're in love with each other, and there being no legal impediment, isn't that enough to constitute an engagement? Aren't you sure that you want to marry me?
Yes, Charles. I'm sure that I want to marry you when I'm free to do so. But by that time, you may have changed your mind. Such things have happened.
That won't happen to me.
Oh, excuse me, Miss Monica. His lordship said to tell you not to wait tea for him.
Thank you, Lambert.
He's busy at the moment, but he won't be very long.
How long will you be imprisoned alone with your father in that very expensive hotel for convalescence to which you're taking him? And what after that?
There are several good reasons why I should go with him.
But better reasons than for marrying me? What reasons?
First, his terror of being alone. In the life he's led, he's never had to be alone. And when he's been at home in the evening, even when he's reading or busy with his papers, he needs to have someone else in the room with him. Someone to make a remark to now and then. And mostly it's been me.
I know it's been you. It's a pity that you haven't had brothers and sisters to share the burden. Well, sisters, I should say, for your brother's never been of any use to you.
And never will be of any use to anybody, I'm afraid. Poor Michael. Mother spoilt him. Father was too severe. So they're always at loggerheads.
But you spoke of several reasons for your going with your father. Is there any better reason than his fear of solitude?
The second reason is exactly the opposite. It's his fear of being exposed to strangers.
But he's most alive when he's among people. Managing, manoeuvring, cajoling or bullying, at all of which he's a master. Strangers.
You don't understand. It's one thing meeting people when you're in authority, with authority's costume, when the man that people see when they meet you is not the private man, but the public personage. In politics, Father wore a public label. And later, as chairman of public companies, always his privacy has been preserved.
His privacy has been so well preserved that I've sometimes wondered whether there was any private self to preserve.
There is a private self, Charles. I'm sure of that.
You've given two reasons, one the contradiction of the other. Can there be a third?
The third reason is this. I've only just been given it by Dr. Selby. Father is much iller than he's aware of. It may be he will never return from Badgley Court. But Selby wants him to have every encouragement. If he's hopeful, he's likely to live a little longer. That's why Selby chose the place. A convalescent home with the atmosphere of an hotel. Nothing about it to suggest the clinic. Everything about it to suggest recovery.
This is your best reason, and the most depressing. For this situation may persist for a long time, and you'll go on postponing and postponing our marriage.
I'm afraid not a very long time, Charles. You can come down at weekends, even when the house is sitting. And you can take me out if Father can spare me. But he'll simply love having you to talk to.
I know, he's used to seeing me about.
I do believe that he is fond of you. So you must come often. And, oh, Charles, you've been very long in coming, Father. What have you been doing?
Good afternoon, Charles. You might have guessed, Monica, what I've been doing. Don't you recognize this book?
It's your engagement.
Yes, I've been brooding over it.
But what a time for your engagement book. You know what the doctor said. Complete relaxation and to think about nothing. Though I know that won't be easy.
It is just what I was doing.
Thinking of nothing?
Contemplating nothingness. Just remember, every day, year after year, over my breakfast, I've looked at this book, or one just like it. You know I keep the old ones on a shelf together. I could look in the right book and find out what I was doing 20 years ago today at this hour of the afternoon. If I'd been looking at this engagement book today, not over breakfast, but before tea, it's the empty pages that I've been fingering. The first empty pages since I entered Parliament. I used to jot down notes of what I had to say to people. Now I've no more to say, no one to say it to. I've been wondering, how many more empty pages?
You would soon fill them up if we allowed you to. That's my business to prevent. You know I'm to protect you from your own restless energy, the inexhaustible sources of the power that wears out the machine.
Well, they've dried up, Monica, and you know it. They talk of rest, these doctors, Charles. They tell me to be cautious, to take life easily. Take life easily. It's like telling a man he mustn't run for trains when the last thing he wants is to take a train for anywhere. No, I've not the slightest longing for the life I've left. Only fear of the emptiness before me. If I had the energy to work myself to death, how gladly I would face death. But waiting, simply waiting with no desire to act, yet a loathing of inaction. A fear of the vacuum and no desire to fill it. It's just like sitting in an empty waiting room at a railway station on a branch line after the last train, after all the other passengers have left and the booking office is closed and the porters have gone. What am I waiting for? In a cold and empty room before an empty grate. For no one. For nothing.
Father, you simply want to revel in gloom. You know you've retired in a blaze of glory. You've read every word about you in the papers.
And the leading articles saying we are confident that his sagacious counsel will long continue to be at the disposal of the government in power, and the expectation that your voice will be heard in debate in the Upper House.
The established liturgy of the press on any conspicuous retirement. My obituary, if I had died in harness, would have occupied a column and a half with an inset, a portrait taken 20 years ago. In 5 years' time, it will be half of that. In 10 years' time, a paragraph.
Well, that's the reward of every public man.
Say rather the exequies of the failed successes, the successful failures, who occupy positions that other men covet. When we go, a good many folk are mildly grieved, and our closest associates, the small minority of those who really understand the place we filled, are inwardly delighted. They won't want my ghost walking in the city or sitting in the Lords. And I, who recognize myself as a ghost, shan't want to be seen there. It makes me smile to think that men should be frightened of ghosts. If they only knew how frightened a ghost can be of men.
Excuse me, my lord. There's a gentleman downstairs. He is very insistent that he must see you. I told him you never saw anyone, my lord, but by previous appointment. He said he knew that, so he brought you this note. He said that when you read it, you'd want to see him. He said you'd be very angry if you'd heard that he'd gone away without your seeing him.
What sort of person?
A foreign person, by the looks of him. But talks good English. A pleasant-spoken gentleman.
I'll see him in the library. No, stop. I've left too many papers about him there. I'd better see him here.
Very good, my lord. Shall I take the tea tray, Miss Monica?
Yes, thank you, Lambert.
I ought to be going.
Let us go into the library. And then I'll see you off.
I'm sorry to turn you out of the room like this, but I'll have to see this man by myself, Monica. I've never heard of this Señor Gomez, but he comes with a letter of introduction from a man I used to know. I can't refuse to see him, though from what I remember of the man who introduces him, I expect he wants money, or to sell me something worthless.
You ought not to bother with such people now, Father. If you haven't got rid of him in 20 minutes, I'll send Lambert to tell you that you have to take a trunk call.
I'll say goodbye, sir, and look forward to seeing you both at Badgley Court in a week or two.
Goodbye, Charles. And please remember that we both want to see you whenever you can come, if you're in the vicinity. Don't we, Monica?
Yes, Father. We both want to see you.
Mr. Gomez, my lord.
Thank you, Lambert. Good evening, Mr. Gomez. You're a friend of Mr. Calverwell?
We're as thick as thieves, you might almost say.
Don't you know me, Dick?
Fred Calverwell. Why do you come back with another name?
You've changed your name, too, since I knew you. When we were up at Oxford, you were plain Dick Ferry. Then, when you married, you took your wife's name and became Mr. Richard Claverton Ferry, and finally Lord Claverton. I followed your example and done the same in a modest way. You know, where I live, people do change their names. And besides, my wife's name is a good deal more normal in my country than Culverwell, and easier to pronounce.
Have you lived out there ever since you left England?
Ever since I finished my sentence.
What has brought you to England?
Call it homesickness, curiosity, restlessness. Whatever you like. But I've been a pretty hard worker all these years, and I thought, now's the time to take a long holiday. Let's say, a rest cure. That's what I've come for. You see, I'm a widower, like you, Dick, so I'm pretty footloose. Gomez, you see, is now a highly respected citizen of a Central American republic, San Marco. It's as hard to become a respected citizen out there as it is here, with this qualification. Out there, they respect you for rather different reasons.
You mean that you won respect out there by the sort of activity that lost you respect here in England?
Not at all. Not at all. I think that was rather an unkind suggestion. I've always kept on the right side of the law, and seen that the law turned its right side to me. Sometimes I've had to pay pretty heavily, but I learnt by experience whom to pay, and a little money laid out in the right manner, in the right places, pays many times over. I assure you it does.
It would seem, then, that most of your business has been of such a nature that, if carried on in England, it might land you in jail again.
That's true enough, except for a false inference. I wouldn't dream of carrying on such business if I lived in England. I have the same standards of morality as the society in which I find myself. I do nothing in England that you would disapprove of.
Well, that's something at least to be thankful for. I trust you've no need to engage in forgery.
Forgery, Dick? An absurd suggestion. Forgery, I can tell you, is a mug's game. I say that with conviction. Dick, don't tell me there isn't any whiskey in the house.
Well, I can provide whiskey. Well, why have you come?
You've asked me that already. To see you, Dick. A natural desire, for you're the only old friend I can trust.
Oh, you really trust me? I appreciate the compliment.
Which you're sure you deserve.
Don't you help yourself.
And what about you?
I don't take it, thank you.
A reformed character.
I should like to know why you need to trust me.
That's perfectly simple. I come back to England after 35 years. Can you imagine what it would be like to have been away from home for 35 years? I was 25. The same age as you when I went away, thousands of miles away, to another climate, to another language, other standards of behaviour, to fabricate for myself another personality, and to take another name. Think what that means. To take another name. But of course you know. Just enough to think you know more than you do. You've changed your name twice, by easy stages, and each step was merely a step up the ladder, so you weren't aware of becoming a different person. But where I changed my name, there was no social ladder. It was jumping a gap, and you can't jump back again. I parted from myself by a sudden effort. You, so slowly and sweetly, that you've never woken up to the fact that Dick Ferry died long ago. Oh, God, Dick, you don't know what it's like to be so cut off. Homesickness. Homesickness is a sickly word. You don't understand such isolation as mine. You think you do.
I'm sure I do. I've always been alone.
Oh, loneliness. Everybody knows what that's like, your loneliness. So cozy, warm and padded. You're not isolated, merely insulated. It's only when you come to see that you have lost yourself that you are quite alone.
I am waiting to hear why you should need to trust me.
Perfectly simple. My father's dead long since. That's a good thing. My mother, I dare say she's still alive, but she must be very old. And she must think I'm dead. And as for my married sisters, I don't suppose their husbands were ever told the story. They wouldn't want to see me. No, I need one old friend, a friend whom I can trust. And one who will accept both Culverwell and Gomez. See Culverwell as Gomez, Gomez as Culverwell. I need you, Dick, to give me reality.
Mm. But according to the description you've given of trusting people, how do you propose to make it worth my while to be trustworthy?
It's done already, Dick. Done many years ago. Adoption tried and grappled to my soul with hoops of steel and all that sort of thing. We'll come to that very soon. Isn't it strange that there should always have been this bond between us?
It has never crossed my mind. Develop the point.
Well, consider what we were when we went up to Oxford, and then what I became under your influence.
Oh, you cannot attribute your misfortune to my influence.
When you started to take me up at Oxford, I've no doubt your friends wondered what you found in me, a scholarship boy from an unknown grammar school. I didn't know either, but I was flattered. Later, I came to understand. You made friends with me because it flattered you. Tickled your love of power to see that I was flattered and that I admired you. Everyone expected that I should get a first. I suppose your tutor thought you'd be sent down. It went the other way. You stayed the course, at least. I had plenty of time to think things over later.
And what is the conclusion that you came to?
This is how it worked out, Dick. You liked to play the rake, but you never went too far. There's a prudent devil inside you, Dick. He never came to my help.
I certainly admit no responsibility, none whatever, for what happened to you later.
You led me on at Oxford and left me to it. And so it came about that I was sent down with the consequences which you remember. A miserable clerkship which your father found for me. And expensive tastes which you had fostered in me. And equally unfortunate, a talent for penmanship. Hence, as you have just reminded me, defalcation and forgery. And then my stretch, which gave me time to think it all out.
But there's just one thing you seem to have forgotten. I came to your assistance when you were released.
Yes, and paid my passage out. I know the reason. You wanted to get rid of me. I shall tell you why presently. Now, let's look for a moment
at your life history. You had plenty of money, and you made a good marriage, or so it seemed. And with your father's money, and your wife's family influence, you got on in politics. Shall we say that you did very well by yourself, though not, I suspect, as well as you had hoped.
I was never accused of making a mistake.
I dare say you did make some mistake, Dick. That would account for your leaving politics and taking a conspicuous job in the city, where the government could always consult you. But, of course, didn't have to take your advice. I've made a point, you see, of following your career.
I am touched by your interest.
I have a gift for friendship. I rejoiced in your success. But one thing has puzzled me. You were given a ministry before you were 50. That should have led you to the very top. And yet you withdrew from the world of politics and went into the city. Director of a bank and chairman of companies, you looked the part, cut out to be an impressive figurehead. But again, you've retired at 60. Why at 60?
Knowing as much about me as you do, you must have read that I retired at the insistence of my doctors.
Oh, yes, the usual euphemism. And yet I wonder. It is surprising. You should have been good for another 5 years, at least. Why did they let you retire?
If you want to know, I had had a stroke, and I might have another.
Yes, you might have another. But I wonder what brought about this stroke. And I wonder whether you're the great economist and financial wizard that you're supposed to be. And I'd learnt something of other vicissitudes. Dick, I was very, very sorry when I heard that your marriage had not been altogether happy. And as for your son, from what I've heard about him, he's followed your undergraduate career without the protection of that prudent devil of yours to tell him not to go too far. Well, now, I'm beginning to be thirsty again. What would have happened to me, I wonder, if I had never met you? I should have got my first, and I might have become the history master in a school like that from which I went to Oxford. As it is, I'm somebody. A more important man in San Marco than I should ever have been in England.
So, as you consider yourself a success...
A worldly success, Dick. In another sense, we're both of us failures. But even so, I'd rather be my kind of failure than yours.
And what do you call failure?
What do I call failure? The worst kind of failure, in my opinion, is the man who has to keep on pretending to himself that he is a success. The man who in the morning has to make up his face before he looks in the mirror.
Isn't that the kind of pretense that you're maintaining in trying to persuade me of your worldly success?
No, because I know the value of the coinage I pay myself in.
Oh, indeed, how interesting. I still don't know why you've come to see me or what you mean by saying you can trust me.
Dick, do you remember the moonlight night we drove back to Oxford? You were driving.
Well, that happened several times.
One time in particular. You know quite well to which occasion I'm referring. A summer night of moonlight and shadows. The night you ran over the old man in the road.
You said I ran over an old man in the road.
You knew it too. If you had been surprised when I said, Dick, you've run over somebody, wouldn't you have shown it, if only for a second? You never lifted your foot from the accelerator.
We were in a hurry.
More than in a hurry. You didn't want it to be known where we'd been. The girls who were with us, what were their names? I've completely forgotten them. You didn't want them to be called to give evidence. You just couldn't face it. Do you see now, Dick, why I say I can trust you?
If you think that this story would interest the public, why not sell your version to a Sunday newspaper?
My dear Dick, what a preposterous suggestion. Who's going to accept the unsupported statement of Federico Gomez of San Marco about something that happened so many years ago? What damages you'd get? The press wouldn't look at it. Besides, you can't think I've any desire to appear in public as Frederick Culverwell. No, Dick, your secret's safe with me. Of course, I might give it to a few friends in confidence. It might even reach the ears of some of your acquaintance. But you'd never know to whom I told it, or who knew the story and who didn't. I promise you. Rely upon me as the soul of discretion.
What do you want, then? You need money?
My dear chap, you are obtuse. I said your secret is safe with me, and then you... Well, I'd never have believed that you would accuse an old friend of blackmail. I dare say I could buy you out several times over. Really, Dick, you owe me an apology. Blackmail? On the contrary, any time you're in a tight corner, my entire resources are at your disposal. You were a generous friend to me once, as you pointedly reminded me a moment ago. Now it's my turn, perhaps, to do you a kindness.
Excuse me, my lord, but Miss Monica asked me to remind you there's a trunk call coming through for you in 5 minutes' time.
I'll be ready to take it.
Ah, the prearranged interruption to terminate the unwelcome intrusion of the visitor in financial distress.
Before you go, what is it that you want?
I've been trying to make clear that I only want your friendship. Just as it used to be in the old days, when you taught me expensive tastes. Now it's my turn. I'm a lonely man, Dick, with a craving for affection. All I want is as much of your company, so long as I stay here, as I can get. And the more I get, the longer I may stay.
This is preposterous. You call it friendship to impose your company on a man by threats? Why keep up the pretense?
Threats, Dick? How can you speak of threats? It's most unkind of you. My only aim is to renew our friendship. Don't you understand?
I see that when I gave you my friendship so many years ago, I only gained in return your envy, spite, and hatred. That is why you attribute your downfall to me. But how was I responsible? We were the same age. You were a free moral agent. You pretend that I taught you expensive taste. If you had not had those tastes already, you would have hardly welcomed my companionship.
Neatly argued and almost convincing. Don't you wish you could believe it?
What have I declined to give you the pleasure of my company?
Oh, I can wait, Dick. You'll relent at last. You'll come to feel easier when I'm with you than when I'm out of sight. You'll be afraid of whispers, the reflection in the mirror of the face behind you, the ambiguous smile, the distant salutation, the sudden silence when you enter the smoking room. Don't forget, Dick, you didn't stop. Well, I'd better be going. I hope I haven't outstayed my welcome. Your telephone pal may be getting impatient. I'll see you soon again.
Not very soon, I think. I'm going away.
So I've been informed. Goodbye for the present. It's been an elixir to see you again. And assure myself that we can begin just where we left off.
Who was it, Father?
Man I used to know.
Oh, so you knew him?
Yes. He changed his name.
Then I suppose he wanted money?
No, he didn't want money.
Father, this interview has worn you out. You must go and rest now before dinner.
Yes, I'll go and rest now. I wish Charles was dining with us. I wish we were having a dinner party.
Father, can't you bear to be alone with me? If you can't bear to dine alone with me tonight, what will it be like at Badgley Court?
Well, so far it's better than you expected, isn't it, Father? They've left us alone. The people in the dining room show no curiosity. The beds are comfortable. The hot water is hot. They give us a very tolerable breakfast.
So far, so good.
I'll feel more confidence after a fortnight, after 14 days of people not staring or offering picture papers or wanting a fourth of bridge. Still, I'll admit to a feeling of contentment already. I only hope that it will last, this sense of well-being. It's often with us when we were young, but then it's not noticed. And by the time one has grown to consciousness, it comes less often.
Oh, let's make the most of this weather while it lasts. I never remember you as other than occupied with anxieties from which you were longing to escape. Now I want to see you learning to enjoy yourself.
Perhaps I've never really enjoyed living as much as most people. At least, as they seem to do without knowing that they enjoy it. Whereas I've often known that I didn't enjoy it. Some dissatisfaction with myself, I suspect, very deep within myself, has impelled me all my life to find justification, not so much to the world, first of all to myself. What is this self inside us, this silent observer, severe and speechless critic, who can terrorize us and urge us on to futile activity, and in the end judge us still more severely for the errors into which his own reproaches drove us?
You admit that at the moment you find life pleasant, that it really does seem quiet here and restful. Even the matron, though she looks rather dominating, has left us alone.
Yes, but remember what she said. She said, "I'm going to leave you alone. We want perfect peace. That's what Badgley Court is for." I thought that very ominous. When people talk like that, it indicates a latent desire to interfere with the privacy of others, which is certain to explode.
I'm going to prowl about the grounds.
Huh?
Don't look so alarmed. If you spy any guest who seems to be stalking you, put your newspaper over your face and pretend you're pretending to be asleep. If they think you are asleep, they'll do something to wake you. But if they see you're shamming, they'll have to take the hint.
I hope I'm not disturbing you. I always sit here. It's the sunniest and most sheltered corner, and none of the other guests have discovered it. It was clever of you to find it so quickly. What made you choose it?
My daughter chose it. She noticed that it seemed to offer the advantages which you have just mentioned. I'm glad you can confirm them.
Oh, so that is your daughter. That very charming girl. And obviously devoted to her father. I was watching you both in the dining room last night. You are the great Lord Claverton, aren't you?
Oh.
Somebody said you were coming here. It's been the topic of conversation. But I couldn't believe that it would really happen. And now I'm sitting here talking to you. Dear me, it's astonishing after all these years. And you don't even recognise me. I'd know you anywhere. But then we've all seen your portrait in the paper so often, and everybody knows you. But still, I wish you could have paid me that compliment, Richard.
What?
Don't you know me yet?
I'm afraid not.
There were the three of us. Effie, Maudie and me, that day we spent on the river. I've never forgotten it. The turning point of all my life. Now, whatever were the names of those friends of yours? And which one was it invited us to lunch? I declare, I've utterly forgotten their names. And he gave us lunch. I've forgotten what to tell. And we all went on a punt on the river. And you made me try to punt, and I got soaking wet and nearly dropped the punt pole, and you all laughed at me, don't you remember?
Pray continue. The more you remind me of, the better I'll remember.
You attracted me, you know, at the very first meeting. I can't think why, but it's the way things happen. I said, there's a man I could follow round the world. But Effie it was. You know, Effie was very shrewd. Effie it was said, you'd be throwing yourself away. Mark my words, Effie said, if you chose to follow that man. He'd give you the slip. He's not to be trusted. That man is hollow. That's what she said. Or did she say yellow? I'm not quite sure. You do remember now, don't you, Richard?
Not the conversation you have just repeated. That is new to me. but I do remember you.
Time has wrought sad changes in me, Richard. I was very lovely once, so you thought. And others thought so too. But as you remember, please, Richard, just repeat my name just once, the name by which you knew me. It would give me such a thrill to hear you speak my name once more.
Your name was Maisie Battersby.
Oh, Richard, you're only saying that to tease me. You know I meant my stage name, the name by which you knew me.
Well, Maisie Mountjoy.
Yes, Maisie Mountjoy. I was Maisie Mountjoy once, and you didn't recognize me.
You've changed your name, no doubt. And I've changed mine. Your name now and here
is Mrs. John Cargill.
Oh, you married, I suppose, many years ago.
Many years ago the first time. That didn't last long. People sometimes say make one mistake in love, you're more than likely to make another. How true that is. Algy was a weakling. But simple he was, not sly and slippery. Then I married Mr. Cargill, 20 years older than me he was. Just what I needed.
Was he still living?
He had a weak heart. And he worked too hard. Have you never heard of Cargill Equipment? They make office furniture.
I've never had to deal with questions of equipment. I trust that the business was very successful. I mean that he left you comfortably provided for.
Well, Richard, my doctor could hardly have sent me here if I wasn't well off. Yes, I'm provided for. But isn't it strange that you and I should meet here at last? Here of all places.
Why not of all places? What I don't understand is why you should take the first opportunity of finding me here to revive old memories which I should have thought we both preferred to leave buried.
There you're wrong, Richard. Effie always said what a clever girl she was. He doesn't understand women. Any woman who trusted him would soon find that out. A man may prefer to forget all the women he has loved, but a woman doesn't want to forget a single one of her admirers. Why, even a faithless lover is still in her memory a kind of testimonial. Men live by forgetting. Women live on memories. Besides, a woman has nothing to be ashamed of. A man is always trying to forget his own shabby behaviour.
But we'd settled our account. What harm was done? I learned my lesson and you learned yours, if you needed the lesson.
You refused to believe that I was really in love with you. Well, it's natural that you shouldn't want to believe it. But you think, or try to think, that if I'd really suffered, I shouldn't want to let you know who I am. I shouldn't want to come and talk about the past. You're wrong, you know. It's both pain and pleasure to talk about the past, about you and me. These memories are painful, but I cherish them.
Mm. If you've really been broken-hearted, I can't see how you could have acted as you did.
Who can say whether a heart's been broken once it's been repaired? But I know what you mean. You mean that I would never have started an action for breach of promise if I'd really cared for you? What sentimental nonsense. One starts an action simply because one must do something. Well, perhaps I shouldn't have settled out of court. My lawyer said I advise you to accept, because Mr. Ferry will be standing for Parliament. His father has political ambitions for him. If he's lost a breach of promise suit, some people won't want to appear as his supporters. He said, what his lawyers are offering in settlement is twice as much as I think you'd be awarded. Effie was against it. She wanted you exposed. But I gave way. I didn't want to ruin you. If I'd carried on, it might have ended your career, and then you wouldn't have become Lord Claverton. So perhaps I laid the foundation of your fortunes.
Perhaps at the same time of your own? I seem to remember it was only a year or so before your name appeared in very large letters in Shaftesbury Avenue.
Yes, I had my art. Don't you remember what a hit I made with a number called It's Not Too Late for You to Love Me? I couldn't have put the feeling into it I did, but for what I'd gone through. Did you hear me sing it?
Yes, I heard you sing it.
And what did you feel?
Nothing at all. I remember my surprise at finding that I felt nothing at all. I thought perhaps what a lucky escape it had been. For both of us.
That both of us was an afterthought, Richard. A lucky escape, you thought, for you. You felt no embarrassment?
Why should I feel embarrassment? My conscience was clear. A brief infatuation ended in the only way possible to our mutual satisfaction.
Your conscience was clear? Ha! I've seldom heard people mention their consciences, except to observe that their consciences were clear. you got out of a tangle for a large cash payment and no publicity. So your conscience was clear. At bottom, I believe you're still the same silly Richard you always were. You wanted to pose as a man of the world. And now you're posing as what? An elder statesman, I presume. And the difference between being an elder statesman and posing successfully as an elder statesman is practically negligible. And you look the part. Whatever part you've played, I must say, you've always looked it.
I've no longer any part to play, Maisie.
There'll always be some sort of part for you, right to the end. You'll still be playing a part in your obituary, whoever writes it.
Considering how long ago it was when you knew me, and considering the brevity of our acquaintance, you're surprisingly confident, I must say, about your understanding of my character.
I've followed your progress year by year, Richard. And although it's true that our acquaintance was brief, our relations were intense enough, I think, to have given me one or two insights into you. Now, Richard, don't imagine that I'm still in love with you. And you needn't think that I idolize your memory. It's simply that I feel we belong together. Now, don't get alarmed. But you touch my soul. Poured it, perhaps. And the touch still lingers. And I've touched yours. It's frightening to think that we're still together. And more frightening to think that we may always be together. There's a phrase I seem to remember reading somewhere. Where their fires are not quenched. Do you know what I do? I read your letters every night.
My letters?
Have you forgotten that you sent me letters? Oh, not very many, only a few worth keeping. Only a few, but very beautiful. Do you remember them?
Vaguely. Were they very passionate?
They were very loving. Would you like to read them? I'm afraid I can't show you the originals. They're in my lawyer's safe. But I have photostats, which are quite as good, I'm told. And I like to read them in your own handwriting.
And you've shown these letters to many people?
Only a few friends. Effie said, if he becomes a famous man, and you should be in want, you could have these letters auctioned. Yes. I'll bring the photostats tomorrow and read them to you.
Father, you look tired.
Oh, indeed. What's the matter?
I met Michael in the drive. He says he must see you. I'm afraid that something unpleasant has happened.
Was he driving his car?
No, he was walking.
Hope he's not had another accident. You know, after that last escapade of his, I've lived in terror of his running over somebody.
Why, Father, should you be afraid of that? This shows how bad your nerves have been. He only ran into a tree.
Yes, a tree. It might have been a man. But he can't be that. Or he wouldn't be at large. Perhaps he's in trouble with some woman or other. I'm sure he has friends whom he wouldn't care for you or me to know about.
It's probably money.
Well, if it's only debts, once more I expect I can put up with it. But where is he?
I told him he must wait in the garden until I had prepared you. I've made him understand that the doctors want you to be free from worry. He won't make a scene. But I can see he's frightened. And you know what Michael is like when he's frightened? He's apt to be sullen and quick to take offence. So I hope you'll be patient.
Well then, fetch him. Let's get this over.
Michael?
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Father. What a lovely day. I'm glad you're here to enjoy such weather.
I'm glad I'm here. Did you drive down from London?
I drove down last night. I'm staying at a pub about 2 miles from here. Not a bad little place.
And why are you staying there? I shouldn't have thought it'd be the sort of place you'd choose for a holiday.
Well, this isn't a holiday exactly. But this hotel was very well recommended. Good cooking for a country inn and not at all expensive.
You don't normally consider that a recommendation. Are you staying there long? For the whole of this holiday?
Well, this isn't a holiday exactly. Oh, I said that before, didn't I?
I wish you'd stop being so polite to each other. Michael, you know what you've come to ask of Father, and Father knows that you want something from him.
Perhaps you'll get to the point if I leave you together.
You know, it's awfully hard to explain things to you. You've always made up your mind that I was to blame before you knew the facts. The first thing I remember is being blamed for something I hadn't done. I never got over that. If you always blame a person, it's natural he should end up by getting into trouble.
You started pretty early getting into trouble when you were expelled from your prep school for stealing. But come to the point. You're in trouble again. We'll ignore, if you please, the question of blame, which will spare you the necessity of blaming someone else. Just tell me what's happened.
Well, I've lost my job.
The position that Sir Alfred Walter made for you?
I'd stuck it for 2 years. Deadly dull it was.
Every job is dull, 9/10 of the time.
I need something more stimulating.
Well?
I want to find some more speculative business.
So you've tried a little private speculation?
If I could have borrowed more, I might have pulled it off.
Borrowed? From whom? Not from the firm.
I went to a lender, a man who a friend of mine recommended. He gave me good terms on the strength of my name. The only good the name has ever done me.
Yeah, on the strength of your name. And what do you call good terms?
I had nothing at all to pay for 2 years. The interest was just added on to the capital.
And how long ago was that?
Nearly 2 years. Time passes pretty quickly when you're in debt.
Have you other debts?
Oh, ordinary debts. My tailor's bill, for instance.
Well, I expected that. It was just the same at Oxford.
It's being your son that gets me into debt. Just because of your name, they insist on giving credit.
And your debts, are they the cause of your being discharged?
Well, partly. Hmm. Sir Alfred did come to hear about it, and so he pretended to be very shocked. Said he couldn't retain any man on his staff who's taken to gambling. He called me a gambler. Said he'd communicate with you about it.
Oh, that accounts for your coming down here so precipitately. In order to let me have your version first. I dare say Sir Alfred's will be rather different.
You don't know what I suffered working in that office in the first place. They all knew the job had been made for me because I was your son. They considered me superfluous. Even the office boys began to sneer at me. I wonder I stood it as long as I did.
And does this bring us to the end of the list of your shortcomings, or did Sir Alfred make other unflattering criticisms?
Well, there was one thing he brought up against me. That I'd been too familiar with one of the girls. He assumed it had gone a good deal further than it had.
Perhaps it had gone further than you're willing to admit.
Well, after all, she was the only one who was at all nice to me. She wasn't exciting, but it served to pass the time. It would never have happened if only I'd been given some interesting work.
And what do you now propose to do with yourself?
I want to go abroad.
You want to go abroad? Well, not a bad idea. A few years out of England, in one of the dominions, might set you on your feet. I have connections, or at least correspondence, almost everywhere. How would you like to go to Western Canada? Or what about sheep farming in New Zealand?
Sheep farming? Good Lord, no, that's not my idea. I want to make money. I want to be somebody on my own account.
But what do you want to do? Where do you want to go? What kind of a life do you think you want?
I simply want to lead a life of my own, according to my own ideas of good and bad, of right and wrong. I want to go far away to some country where no one has heard the name of Claverton, or where if I took a different name, and I might choose to, no one would know or care what my name had been.
So you are ready to repudiate your family? To throw away the whole of your inheritance?
What is my inheritance? As for your title, I know why you took it, and Mother knew. First, because it gave you the opportunity of retiring from politics, not without dignity, being no longer wanted. And you wish to be Lord Claverton. Also to hold your own with Mother's family. To lord it over them, in fact. Oh, I've no doubt that the thought of passing on your name and title to a son was gratifying. But it wasn't for my sake. I was just your son. That is to say, a kind of prolongation of your existence. A representative carrying on business in your absence. Why should I thank you for imposing this upon me? And what satisfaction, I wonder, will it give you in the grave?
So you want me to help you to escape from your father?
And to help my father to be rid of me. You simply don't know how very much pleasanter you will find life become once I'm out of the country. What I'd like is a chance to go abroad as a partner in some interesting business. But I might be expected to put up some capital.
What sort of business have you in mind?
Oh, I don't know. Import and export with an opportunity of profits both ways.
This is what I will do for you, Michael. I will help you make a start in any business you may find for yourself if, on investigation, I am satisfied about the nature of the business.
Anyway, I'm determined to get out of England.
Michael, are there reasons for your wanting to go beyond what you've told me? It isn't manslaughter.
Manslaughter? Why manslaughter? Oh, you mean on the road? Certainly not. I'm far too good a driver.
Oh, there. That young woman?
Oh, I'm not such a fool as to get myself involved in a breach of promise suit or somebody's divorce. No, you needn't worry about that girl or any other. But I want to get out. I'm fed up with England.
No, I'm sure you don't mean that. But it's natural enough to want a few years abroad. Might be very good for you. Find your feet. But I shouldn't like to think that what inspired you was no positive ambition, but only the desire to escape.
I'm not a fugitive.
No, not a fugitive from justice. Only a fugitive from reality. Oh, Michael, if you had some aim of high achievement, some dream of excellence, how gladly I would help you, even though it carried you away from me forever to suffer the monotonous sun of the tropics or shiver in the northern night. Believe me, Michael, those who flee from their past will always lose the race. I know this from experience. When you reach your goal, your imagined paradise of success and grandeur, you will find your past failures waiting there to greet you. You're all I have to live for, Michael, you and Monica. If I live for 20 years knowing that my son had played the coward, I should merely be another 20 years in dying.
Very well, if you like, call me a coward. I wonder whether you'd play the hero if you were in my place. I don't believe you would. You didn't suffer from the handicap that I've had. Your father was rich, but was no one in particular, so you'd nothing to live up to. Those standards of conduct you've always made so much of for my benefit, I wonder whether you have always lived up to them.
Michael! Oh. How can you speak to Father like that? Father, what happened? Why do you look so angry? I know that Michael must be in great trouble, so can't you help him?
I am trying to help him, and to meet him halfway. I have made him an offer which he must think over. But if he goes abroad, I want him to go in a very different spirit from that which he has just been exhibiting.
Michael, say something.
What is there to say? I want to leave England and make my own career, and Father simply calls me a coward.
Father, you know that I would give my life for you. Oh, how silly that phrase sounds. But there's no vocabulary for love within a family. Love that's lived in but not looked at. Love within the light of which all else is seen. The love within which all other love finds speech. This love is silent. What can I say to you? However Michael has behaved, Father, whatever Father has said, Michael, you must forgive each other. You must love each other.
I could have loved Father if he'd wanted love. But he never did, Monica, not from me. You know I've always been very fond of you. I've a very affectionate nature, really.
Richard, I didn't think you'd still be here. I came back to have a quiet read of your letters. But how nice to find a little family party. I know who you are. You're Monica, of course. And this must be your brother, Michael. I'm right, aren't I?
Yes, you're right.
How did I know? Because you're so like your father when he was your age. He's the picture of you, Richard, as you were once. You're not to introduce us. I'll introduce myself. I'm Maisie Mountjoy. That means nothing to you, my dears. It's a very long time since the name of Maisie Mountjoy topped the bill in review. Now I'm Mrs. John Cargill. Your father was a very dear friend of mine once.
Did he really look like me?
You've his voice and his way of moving. It's marvellous. And the charm. He's inherited all of your charm, Richard. There's no denying it. But who's this coming? There's another new guest here. He's waving to us. Do you know him, Richard?
It's a man I used to know.
How interesting. He's a very good figure. And he's rather exotic looking. Is he a foreigner?
He comes from some place in Central America.
Ah, romantic. I'd love to meet him. He's coming to speak to us. You must introduce him.
Good morning, Dick.
Morning, Fred.
You weren't expecting me to join you here, were you? You're here for a rest cure. I persuaded my doctor that I was in need of a rest cure, too. And when I heard you'd chosen to come to Badgley Court, I said to my doctor, well, what about it? What better recommendation could I have? So he sent me here.
Oh, so you've seen each other lately. Richard, I think you might introduce us.
Oh, this is...
your old friend Federico Gomez, the prominent citizen of San Marco.
So let me introduce you by that name to Mrs.
John Cargill.
We seem a bit weak on the surnames, Dick.
Well, you see, Senor Gomez, when we first became friends, Lord Clapperton and I was known by my stage name. There was a time once when everyone in London knew the name of Maisie Montjoy in review.
If Maisie Montjoy was as beautiful to look at as Mrs. Cargill, I can well understand her success on the stage.
Oh, did you never see me? That's a pity, Senor Gomez.
I lost touch with things in England. Had I been in London and in Dick's position, I should have been your most devoted admirer.
It's not too late for you to love me. That's the song that made my reputation, Senor Gomez.
It will never be too late. Don't you agree, Dick? This young lady I take to be your daughter. And this is your son.
This is my son, Michael. And my daughter, Monica.
How do you do? Michael?
How do you do?
I don't believe you've known Lord Clapperton as long as I have, Senor Gomez.
My dear lady, you're not old enough to have known Dick Ferry as long as I have. We were friends at Oxford.
Oh, so you were at Oxford. That's how you come to speak such perfect English. Of course, I could tell from your looks that you were Spanish. I do like Spaniards. They're so aristocratic. But it's very strange that we've never met before. You were a friend of Richard at Oxford, and Richard and I became great friends not long afterwards. Didn't we, Richard?
I expect that was after I had left England.
Of course, that explains it. After Oxford, I suppose you went back to... where is your home?
The Republic of San Marco.
Went back to San Marco. Senor Gomez, if it's true you're staying at Badgley Court, I warn you, I'm going to cross-examine you and make you tell me all about Richard in his Oxford days.
On one condition, that you tell me all about Dick when you knew him.
Secret for secret, Senor Gomez.
Father, I think you should take your rest now. I must explain that the doctors were very insistent that my father should rest and have absolute quiet before every meal.
But Michael and I must continue our discussion. This afternoon, Michael.
No, I think you've had enough talk for today. Michael, as you're staying so close at hand, will you come back in the morning after breakfast?
Yes, come tomorrow morning.
Well, I'll come tomorrow morning.
Are you staying in the neighbourhood, Michael? Your father's such an old friend of mine that it seems most natural to call you Michael. You don't mind, do you?
No, I don't mind. I'm staying at the George. It's not far away.
Then I'd like to walk a little way with you.
Delighted, I'm sure.
Taking a holiday? You're in business in London, aren't you?
No, not a holiday, no. I've been in business in London, but I think of cutting loose and going abroad.
You must tell me all about it. Perhaps I could advise you. We'll leave you now, Richard. Au revoir, Monica. And Senor Gomez, I shall hold you to your promise.
Well, Dick, we've got to obey our doctor's orders. But while we're here, we must have some good talks about old times. Bye-bye for the present.
Oh.
Father, those awful people. We mustn't stay here. I want you to escape from them.
What I want to escape from is myself. Is the past. What a coward I am to talk of escaping. And what a hypocrite. A few minutes ago I was pleading with Michael not to try to escape from his own past failures. I said I knew from experience. Do I understand the meaning of the lesson I would teach? Come, I'll start to learn again. Michael and I shall go to school together. We'll sit side by side at little desks and suffer the same humiliations at the hands of the same master. But have I still time? There's time for Michael. Is it too late for me, Monica?
Well, Monica, here I am. I hope you got my message.
Oh, Charles. Charles, I'm so glad you've come. I've been so worried and rather frightened. Charles, how I've wanted you. And now I need you.
Oh, my darling, what I want is to know that you need me. On that last day in London, you admitted that you loved me. But I wondered, I'm sorry, I couldn't help wondering how much your words meant. You didn't seem to need me then. And you said we weren't engaged yet.
We're engaged now. Oh. At least I'm engaged. I'm engaged to you forever.
Well, there's another shopping expedition we must make. But, my darling, since I got your letter this morning about your father and Michael and those people from his past, I've been trying to think what I could do to help him. If it's blackmail, and that's very much what it looks like, do you think I could persuade him to confide in me?
Oh, Charles, how could anyone blackmail Father? I just can't imagine it. I never expected you from that direction, Father. I thought you were indoors. Where have you been?
Not far away. Standing under the great beech tree.
Why under the beech tree?
I feel drawn to that spot. No matter. I heard what you said about guilty secrets. There are many things not crimes, Monica. Beyond anything of which the law takes cognizance. Temporary failures, irreflective aberrations, reckless surrenders, unexplainable impulses. Moments we regret in the very next moment. Episodes we try to conceal from the world. Has there been nothing in your life, Charles Hemington, which you wish to forget? Which you wish to keep unknown?
There are certainly things I would gladly forget, sir. Or rather, which I wish had never happened. I can think of things you don't yet know about me, Monica. There's nothing I would ever wish to conceal from you.
If there's nothing, truly nothing, that you couldn't tell Monica, then all is well with you. You're in love with each other. I don't need to be told what I've seen for myself. And if there's nothing that you conceal from her, however important you may consider it to conceal from the rest of the world, your soul is safe. If a man has one person, just one in his life, to whom he is willing to confess everything, then he loves that person, and his love will save him. I'm afraid that I've never loved anyone, really. No, I do love my Monica. But there's the impediment. It's impossible to be quite honest with your child if you've never been honest with anyone older on terms of equality. To one's child, one can't reveal oneself while she is a child. And by the time she's grown, you've woven such a web of fiction about you. I've spent my life in trying to forget myself, in trying to identify myself with the part I had chosen to play. And the longer we pretend, the harder it becomes to drop the pretense, walk off the stage, change into our own clothes, and speak as ourselves. And so, I've become an idol to Monica. She worshipped the part I played. How could I be sure that she would love the actor if she saw him off the stage without his costume and makeup and without his stage words? Monica, I've had your love under false pretenses. Now I'm tired of keeping up those pretenses. But I hope you'll find a little love in your heart still for your father when you know him for what he is, the broken-down actor.
I think I should only love you the better, Father, the more I knew about you. I should understand you better. There's nothing I'm afraid of learning about Charles. There's nothing I'm afraid of learning about you.
I was thinking, sir, forgive the suspicion, but I was thinking that if there's any question of blackmail, I've seen something of it in my practice at the bar. I'm sure I could help.
Oh, Father, do let him.
At least I think I know the best man to advise you.
Blackmail, yes, I've heard that word before, not so very long ago, when I asked him what he wanted. Oh, no, he said. I want nothing from you except your friendship and your company. He's a very rich man, and she's a rich woman. If people merely blackmail you to get your company, I'm afraid the law can't touch them.
But then why should you submit? Why not leave Badgley and escape from them?
Because they're not real, Charles. They are merely ghosts, specters from my past. They've always been with me. But it was not until lately that I found the living persons whose ghosts tormented me to be only human beings. Malicious, petty. And I see myself emerging from my spectral existence into something like reality.
But what did the ghosts mean? All these years you've kept them to yourself. Did Mother know of them?
Your mother knew nothing about them. And I know that I never knew your mother as she never knew me. I thought she would never understand, or that she would be jealous of the ghosts who haunted me. And I'm still of that opinion. How open one's heart when one is sure of the wrong response? How make a confession with no hope of absolution? It was not her fault. We never understood each other. And so we lived, with a deep silence between us. And she died silently. She had nothing to say to me. I think of your mother when she lay dying, completely without interest in the life that lay behind her, and completely indifferent to whatever lay ahead of her.
It is time to break the silence. Let us share your ghosts.
But these are only human beings who can be dealt with.
Or only ghosts who can be exorcised.
And yet they've both done better for themselves in consequence of it all. He admitted as much, Fred Culverwell.
Fred Culverwell? Who is Fred Culverwell?
He no longer exists. He's Frederico Gomez, a Central American. A man who's made a fortune by his own peculiar methods. A man of great importance and the highest standing in his adopted country. As for Maisie Batterson...
Maisie Batterson? Who's Maisie Batterson?
She no longer exists. Nor the musical comedy star Maisie Montjoy. There is Mrs. John Cargill, the wealthy widow. But Freddie Culverwell and Maisie Batterson and Dick Ferry too and Richard Ferry, these are my ghosts. They were people with good in them. People who might all have been very different from Gomez, Mrs. Cargill, and Lord Claverton. Freddie admired me when we were at Oxford. What did I make of his admiration? I led him to acquire tastes beyond his means. So, he became a forger. And so, he served his term. Was I responsible for that weakness in him? Yes, I was. And Maisie loved me, with whatever capacity for loving she had, self-centered and foolish. But we should respect love always when we meet it. Even when it's vain and selfish, we must not abuse it. That is where I failed. And the memory frets me.
But all the same, these two people mustn't persecute you. We can't allow that. What hold have they upon you?
I'll tell you. Very briefly and simply. As for Frederick Culverwell, he re-enters my life to make himself a reminder of one occasion, the memory of which he knows very well, has always haunted me. I was driving back to Oxford. We had two girls with us. It was late at night, a secondary road. I ran over an old man lying in the road, and I did not stop. Then another man ran over him, the lorry driver. He stopped and was arrested, but was later discharged. It was definitely shown that the old man had died a natural death and had been run over after he was dead. It was only a corpse that we had run over. So neither of us killed him. But I didn't stop. And all my life I've heard from time to time, when I least expected, between waking and sleeping, a voice that whispered, "You didn't stop." I knew the voice. It was Fred Culverwell's.
Poor father. All your life. And no one to share it with. I never knew how lonely you were, or why you were lonely.
And Mrs. Cargill, what is she against you?
I was her first lover. I would have married her, but my father prevented that. In fact, we were wholly unsuited to each other. Yet she had a peculiar physical attraction, which no other woman has had
And she knows it. And she knows that the ghost of the man I was still clings to the ghost of the woman who was Maisie. We should have been poor. We should certainly have quarrelled. We should have been unhappy, might have come to divorce. But she hasn't forgotten or forgiven me.
This man and this woman who are so vindictive, don't you see that they were as much at fault as you and they know it? But that's why they are inspired with revenge. It's their means of self-justification. Let them tell their versions of their miserable stories. Confide them in whispers. They cannot harm you.
Your reasoning is sound enough, but it's irrelevant. Each of them remembers an occasion on which I ran away. Very well. I shan't run away now. Run away from them. It is through this meeting that I shall at last escape them. I've made my confession to you, Monica. That is the first step taken towards my freedom, and perhaps the most important. I know what you think. You think that I suffer from a morbid conscience, from brooding over faults I might well have forgotten. You think I'm sickening, but I'm just recovering. What has made the difference in the last 5 minutes is not the heinousness of my misdeeds, but the fact of my confession. And to you, Monica, to you, of all people.
I grant you all that. But what do you propose? How long, Lord Claverton, will you stay here and endure this persecution?
To the end. Place and time of liberation are, I think, determined. Let us say no more about it. Meanwhile, I feel sure they are conspiring against me. I see Mrs. Cargill coming.
Let us go.
No, we will stay here. Let her join us.
I've been hunting high and low for you, Richard. I've some very exciting news for you. But I suspect. Dare I? Yes, I'm sure of it, Monica. I can tell by the change in your expression today, this must be your fiancé. Do introduce him.
Mr. Charles Hemington. Mrs. Cargill.
How do you do?
What a charming name.
I'm glad my name meets with your approval, Mrs. Cargill.
And let me congratulate you, Mr. Hemington. You're a very lucky man to get a girl like Monica. I take a great interest in her future. Fancy, I've only known her 2 days, but I feel like a mother to her already. You may say that I just miss being a mother. I've known a father a very long time, and there was a moment when I almost married him. Oh, so long ago. So you see, Mr. Hemington, I've come to regard her as my adopted daughter. So much so that it seems odd to call you Mr. Hemington. I'm going to call you Charles.
As you please, Mrs. Cargill.
You said you had some exciting news for us. Would you care to impart it?
It's about dear Michael.
Oh? What about Michael?
He's told me all his story. You have cruelly misunderstood him, Richard. How he must have suffered. So I put on my thinking cap. And in the end, I discovered what Michael really wanted for making a new start. He wants to go abroad and find his own way in the world. That's very natural. So I thought, why not appeal to Senor Gomez? He's a wealthy man and very important in his own country, and a friend of Michael's father. And I found him only too ready to help.
And what was Senor Gomez able to suggest?
Ah, that's the surprise for which I've come to prepare you. Dear Michael is so happy. All his problems are solved. And he was so perplexed, poor lamb. Ah, let's all rejoice together.
Oh, Michael, you know I expected you this morning, but you never came.
No, Father. I'll explain why.
And I learn that you have discussed your problems with Mrs. Cargill and then with Senor Gomez.
When I spoke, Father, of my wish to get abroad, you couldn't see my point of view. What's the use of chasing half round the world for the same sort of job you got me here in London? No. I want to go where I can make my own way, not merely be your son. That's what Senor Gomez sees. He understands my point of view if you don't. And he's offered me a job, which is just what I wanted.
Yes, I see the advantage of a job created for you by Senor Gomez.
It's not created for me. Senor Gomez came to London to find a man to fill it, and he thinks I'm just the man.
Yes, wasn't it extraordinary?
Well, of course you're just the man that Senor Gomez wants, but in a different sense, for different reasons from what you think. Let me tell you about Gomez. He's unlikely to try to be custodian of your morals. His real name is Culverwell.
My dear Dick, you're wasting your time rehearsing ancient history. Michael knows it already. I've told him myself. I thought he'd better learn the facts from me before he heard your distorted version. But, Dick,
I was nettled by that insinuation about my not being custodian of Michael's morals. That is just what I should be. And most appropriate, isn't it, Dick, when we recall that you were once custodian of my morals? Though, of course, you went a little faster than I did.
On that point, Fred, you're wasting your time. My daughter and my future son-in-law understand that illusion. I have told them the story in explanation of our intimacy, which they found puzzling.
Oh, Richard. Have you explained to them our intimacy, too?
I have indeed.
The romance of my life. Your father was simply irresistible in those days. I melted the first time he looked at me. Someday, Monica, I'll tell you all about it.
I am satisfied with what I know already, Mrs. Cargill, about you.
And now, Michael, Senor Gomez says he has told you his story. Did he include the fact that he served a term in prison?
He told me everything. It was his experience with you that made him so understanding of my predicament.
But what are your duties to be? Do you know?
We didn't go into details. There's time for that later.
Much better to wait until we get there. The nature of business in San Marco is easier explained in San Marco than in England.
Perhaps you intend to change your name to Gomez.
Oh, no, Dick. There are plenty of other good names.
Oh, Michael. Michael, you can't abandon your family and your very self. It's a kind of suicide.
Michael. You think Senor Gomez is inspired by benevolence?
I told you, he'd come to London looking for a man for an important post on his staff.
A post the nature of which is left very vague.
It's confidential, I tell you.
So I can imagine, highly confidential.
Be careful, Mr. Barrister. You ought to know something about the law of slander. Here's Mrs. Cargill, a reliable witness.
I know enough about the law of libel and slander to know that you are hardly likely to invoke it. And, Michael, here's another point to think of. Signor Gomez has offered you a post in San Marco. Signor Gomez pays your passage.
And an advance of salary.
Signor Gomez pays your passage.
Just as many years ago, his father paid mine.
Well, this return of past kindness no doubt gives you pleasure.
Yes, it's always pleasant to repay an old debt. And better late than never.
I see your point of view. Can you really feel confidence, Michael, in a man who aims to gratify, through you, his lifelong grievance against your father? Remember, you put yourself completely in the power of a man you don't know, of the nature of whose business you know nothing. All you can be sure of is that he served a prison sentence for forgery.
Well, Michael, what do you say to all this?
I'll say that Hammington has plenty of cheek. Signor Gomez and I have talked things over, Hammington.
As two men of the world, we discuss things very frankly. And I can tell you, Michael's head is well screwed on. He's got brains. He's got flair. When he does come back, he'll be able to buy you out many times over.
Richard, you must not bar his way. That would be shameful.
I cannot bar his way, as you know very well. Michael's a free agent. So if he chooses to place himself in your power, Fred Culverwell, of his own volition, to contract his enslavement, I cannot prevent him. I have something to say to you, Michael, before you go. I shall never repudiate you, though you repudiate me. I see now clearly the many, many mistakes I have made my whole life through. Mistake upon mistake. The mistaken attempts to correct mistakes by methods which prove to be equally mistaken. I see that your mother and I, in our failure to understand each other, both misunderstood you in our divergent ways. When I think of your childhood, when I think of the happy little boy who was Michael, when I think of your boyhood and adolescence, and see how all the efforts aimed at your good only succeeded in defeating each other, how can I feel anything but sorrow? And compunction.
Oh, Michael, remember, you're my only brother and I'm your only sister. You never took much notice of me. When we were growing up, we seldom had the same friends. I took all that for granted. So I didn't know till now how much it means to me to have a brother.
Why, of course, Monica, you know I'm very fond of you. Though we never really seem to have much in common. We don't meet often, but if we're fond of each other, that needn't interfere with your life or mine.
Oh, Michael, you haven't understood a single word of what I've said. It's not a question of your going abroad, but a question of the spirit which inspired your decision. If you wish to renounce your father and your family, what is left between you and me?
That makes no difference. You'll be seeing me again.
But who will you be when I see you again? Whoever you are then, I shall always pretend that it is the same Michael.
And when do you leave England?
When we get a passage, and I must buy my kit. We're just going up to London. Signor Gomez will attend to my needs for that climate.
It's wonderful, Signor Gomez, how you manage everything. No sooner had I put my proposal before him than he had it all planned out. It really was an inspiration, on my part, I mean. Are you listening to me, Richard? You look very distraught. You ought to be excited.
Is this goodbye, then, Michael?
Well, that just depends. I could look in again, if there's any point in it. Personally, I think that when one's come to a decision, it's as well to say goodbye at once and be done with it.
Yes, if you're going, and I see no way to stop you, then I agree with you. The sooner the better. We may never meet again, Michael.
I don't see why not.
At the end of 5 years, he will get his first leave.
Well, there's nothing more to say, is there?
Nothing at all.
Then we might as well be going.
Yes, we might as well be going. You'll be grateful to me in the end, Dick.
Goodbye, Michael. Will you let me write to you?
Oh, I'm glad you reminded me. Here's my business card with the full address. You can always reach him there, but it takes some days, you know, even by airmail.
Take the card, Charles. If I write to you, Michael, will you ever answer?
Of course, Monica. You know I'm not much of a correspondent, but I'll send you a card now and then, just to let you know I'm flourishing.
Yes, write to Monica.
Well, goodbye, Dick. And goodbye, Monica. Goodbye, Mr. Hemmington.
Goodbye, Michael.
I'm afraid this seems awfully sudden to you, Richard. It isn't so sudden. We talked it all over. But I've got a little piece of news of my own. Next autumn, I'm going out to Australia on my doctor's advice. And on my way back, Senor Gomez has invited me to visit San Marco. I'm so excited. But what pleases me most is that I shall be able to bring you news of Michael. And now that we've found each other again, we must always keep in touch. But you better rest now. You're looking rather tired. I'll run and see them off.
Oh, Father. Father, I'm so sorry. But perhaps Michael may learn his lesson. I believe he'll come back. If it's all a failure, homesickness, I'm sure, will bring him back to us. If he prospers, that will give him confidence. It's only self-confidence that Michael is lacking. Father, it's not you and me he rejects, but himself, the unhappy self that he's ashamed of. I'm sure he loves us.
Monica, my dear, what you say comes home to me. I fear for Michael. Nevertheless, you are right to hope for something better. When he comes back, if he comes back, I know that you and Charles will do what you can to make him feel that he is not estranged from you.
We will indeed. We shall be ready to welcome him and give him all the aid we can. But it's both of you together make the force to attract him. You and Monica combined.
I shall not be here. You heard me say to him that this might be a final goodbye. I'm sure of it now. Perhaps it is as well.
What do you mean, Father? You'll be here to greet him. But one thing I'm convinced of, you must leave Badgley Court.
Monica is right, you should leave.
This may surprise you. I feel at peace now. It is the peace that ensues upon contrition, when contrition ensues upon knowledge of the truth. Why did I always want to dominate my children? Why did I mark out a narrow path for Michael? Because I wanted to perpetuate myself in him. Why did I want to keep you to myself, Monica? Because I wanted you to give your life to adoring the man that I pretended to myself that I was, so that I could believe in my own pretenses. I've only just now had the illumination of knowing what love is. We all think we know, but how few of us do. And now I feel happy, in spite of everything, in defiance of reason. I have been brushed by the wing of happiness. And I am happy, Monica, that you have found a man whom you can love for the man he really is.
Oh, Father, I've always loved you. But I love you more since I've come to know you here at Badgley Court. And I love you the more because I love Charles.
Yes, my dear. Your love is for the real Charles, not a make-believe. As was your love for me.
But not now, Father. It's the real you I love. The man you are, not the man I thought you were.
And Michael. I love him even for rejecting me. For the me he rejected, I reject also. I have been freed from the self that pretends to be someone. And in becoming no one, I begin to live. It is worthwhile dying to find out what life is. And I love you, my daughter, the more truly for knowing that there is someone you love more than your father, that you love and are loved. And now that I love Michael, I think for the first time, remember, my dear, I'm only a beginner in the practice of loving. Well, that is something. I shall leave you for a while. This is your first visit to us at Badgley Court, Charles, and not at all what you were expecting. I'm sorry you've had to see so much of persons and situations, not very agreeable. You two ought to have a little time together. I leave Monica to you. Look after her, Charles, now and always. I shall take a stroll.
At this time of day? You'll not go far, will you? You know you're not allowed to stop out late at this season. It's chilly at dusk.
Yes, it's chilly at dusk. But I'll be warm enough. I shall not go far.
He's a very different man from the man he used to be. As if he had passed through some door unseen by us and had turned and was looking back at us with a glance of farewell.
I can't understand his going for a walk.
He wanted to leave us alone together.
Yes, he wanted to leave us alone together. And yet, Charles, though we've been alone today only a few minutes, I've felt all the time...
I know what you're going to say. We were alone together in some mysterious fashion. Even with Michael, and despite those people... Because somehow we'd begun to belong together. That awareness...
was a shield protecting both of us.
So that now we are conscious of a new person who is you and me together. Oh, my dear, I love you to the limits of speech and beyond.
I've loved you from the beginning of the world. Before you and I were born, the love was always there that brought us together. Oh, Father, Father, I could speak to you now.
Let me go and find him.
We will go to him together. He is close at hand, though he has gone too far to return to us. He's under the beech tree. It is quiet and cold there. In becoming no one, he has become himself. He is only my father now, and Michael's. And I'm happy. Isn't it strange, Charles, to be happy at this moment?
It's not at all strange. The dead has poured out a blessing on the living.
Age and decrepitude can have no terrors for me. Loss and vicissitude cannot appall me. Not even death can dismay or amaze me, fixed in the certainty of love unchanging. I feel utterly secure in you. I am a part of you. Now take me to my father.
In The Elder Statesman by T.S. Eliot, Lord Claverton was played by Frederick Treves, with Alexander Matthey as Monica, Martin Clunes as Charles, Paulette O'Neill as Mrs. Cargill, Hugh Dixon as Gomez, Ian Michie as Michael, and Philip Sully as Lambert. The play was directed by Patrick Rayner.